Want to virtualize your biggest workloads? Bring the performance of cloud computing inside your data center with the only server built from the cloud up.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of TechNet Radio, where we're going through a series of episodes on Hyper-V from a VMware admin's perspective. Back with me today, I have Andy Serwich from Trivalent Group. Hey Andy, how's it going?
Good, how's it going, Keith?
Good. Thanks for joining us again today.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure thing. Hey, do you want to give everyone an overview of kind of your background and then what you do over at Trivalent Group?
Yeah. Again, my name is Andy Serwich. I am a virtual systems administrator for Trivalent Group, kind of focusing on managed services, virtualization, and the Windows Server platform. Trivalent Group is a service provider in the Grand Rapids, Michigan area, and we primarily do business and provide a way for our customers to manage, access, protect, and store their data. Everything we do kind of goes towards that idea. So.
Great, and it sounds like then you've got background on both administering VMware platforms as well as kind of growing into administering Hyper-V as part of your offering, is that right? That's
correct, yep. I started back in the VMware 3.0, 3.5 days on the VMware side, and I've since grown into administering Hyper-V, you know, 2008, 2008 R2, and now into the 2012 platform as well.
Great, and soon 2012 R2.
Yep, that's correct. Getting into that a little bit already.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that for all of the virtualized infrastructure that you host or that your team supports and advises clients on, storage is probably a big area for you guys, right?
That's always a major consideration, you know, whether it's a small customer and they're interested in some sort of shared storage infrastructure, or you know, they're running local storage because that's all they can afford. The discussion always comes up, whether it's in the sales process or the colo discussion. You know, storage is always a concern, absolutely.
Yeah, and it seems like for the IT pros I've talked to that are still running VMware in their environment, that after you get past the cost of VMware licenses, storage is usually their next major chunk of cost year over year oftentimes, because storage is one thing that never seems to decrease in enterprise and mid-market organizations. It keeps growing. Has that been your experience too, Andy?
Absolutely. Just grows and grows, and customers are always looking at that price per gigabyte type of situation, and It never gets any better. You know, data just grows and grows, and you know, people are shocked that, whoa, wait, what do you mean I had 20% growth last year? Well, it happens, and usually it's legitimate growth, so it's always a concern.
Definitely, and I imagine as you were beginning to move over from VMware to Hyper-V, even in your own shop, you had a lot of evaluation time and considerations around storage. And from a VMware standpoint, what do most of your servers and customers leverage, iSCSI or Fiber Channel or NFS for storage, or is it a mix of all three?
It's kind of a mix, but I will say probably 70 to 80% of it is going to be on the iSCSI side, with the other 20% being NFS and Fiber Channel based.
Okay, great. Well, and certainly with Server 2012 and 2012 R2 both, we have great support for existing storage investments around both iSCSI and Fiber Channel SANs. So if you know customers have or IT pros already have storage in their environment and they want to leverage some of that untapped capacity for some new Hyper-V hosts, we've got built-in support in the box for iSCSI. We've got built-in support for Fiber Channel as well, accessed either at a host level or at a virtual machine level, because we can pass through Fiber Channel connections to VMs now, and from within a VM we can certainly attach iSCSI storage through the built-in iSCSI initiator. And then from a resiliency standpoint, I imagine, you know, resiliency has been pretty important probably for most of my customers and IT pros I know from a storage standpoint, probably from your standpoint as well, Andy, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way I describe it to customers is, you know, you always want to have resiliency on your storage backend, because I liken it to the idea that if you have a running physical box and your storage just suddenly isn't there anymore, you know, that's the equivalent of walking up to a workstation and pulling the SATA cable on the hard drive.
Yeah,
not a good situation. You don't want that happening to your server infrastructure.
Pulling the proverbial storage rug out from underneath your servers, right? Yeah, definitely.
Things don't end well when that happens.
So for iSCSI and fiber channel connections, we have built-in support for MPIO. And, you know, as you're implementing MPIO storage out there, you'll want to talk definitely to your storage vendor to see if they have their own MPIO device-specific module or DSM that'll plug into our MPIO stack. If not, we have our own generic MPIO module, but a lot of storage vendors have their own device-specific module as well to provide additional capabilities when it comes to how multiple storage paths are load balanced or failed over with their storage array through iSCSI or fiber channel. So we've got that support definitely really on par with what VMware offers for traditional storage investments. However, we have made some cool improvements, even with those traditional investments in 2012 and 2012 R2 for intelligent SAN arrays. If your intelligent SAN arrays support offloaded data transfer or ODX support. ODX is kind of a standard feature in the storage industry. A lot of SAN arrays out there support it. And we introduced the feature in 2012, and it was really useful for doing things like moving large virtual hard disks back and forth, because instead of having to suck that across your storage network, just leaves it all on array and has your storage array do all the heavy lifting of moving those blocks back and forth. So you can get lightning fast storage live migrations from one location to another on an ODX enabled storage array. And then with R2, we've also improved the use cases around VM deployment as well. So if you're deploying from templates that are located perhaps in a library or a shared folder on an ODX enabled SAN array, and you're deploying to your SAN array, ODX can greatly assist in that process as well by keeping that whole all the heavy lifting of that deployment traffic on array too. So in the VMware world, it's ODX is kind of similar to some of what VMware had traditionally supported in their VAAI, vSphere array integration API. But a lot of environments are also looking for ways of reducing cost in storage, and you know, intelligent SAN arrays are, if nothing else, they're really expensive, give great performance, but they're really expensive as well. And in Server 2012 and 2012 R2, we've also introduced some great opportunities for leveraging commodity storage around storage spaces to virtualize, take commodity hard disks and virtualize them into resilient, very performant shared hard disk arrays, and also our SMB 3.0 support for then presenting that out to lots of Hyper-V hosts. Andy, in your environment, have you had a chance to evaluate storage spaces yet? Have you had any good feedback or results on that?
We've certainly tested it out, and I've played with it a lot myself as well. And we've started talking about it now in the sales cycle, and in my opinion, it's a real game changer. You know, with the ability to now sell commodity hardware and get the same performance with storage spaces in Server 2012, customers always like to hear that they can pay less for storage. That really helps us pull in more business. And in regards to our data center environment, our cloud environment, we've always had the fact that we'll put in a whole new drive cage on our SAN, and in a week it's sold. I mean, we go through storage so fast. The ability to do that cheaper at a service provider level helps us keep our bottom line down while providing the same service to our customers. So the storage space is a real game changer, and I'm really, really interested to see it you know, come to fruition in our environment as well as our customer environments as well.
Sure, yeah, definitely. And when we talk about commodity storage, we're really talking about leveraging the same hard disk technology in many cases that enterprise SAN or NAS arrays, kind of the expensive intelligent SAN and NAS arrays have, enterprise SSD, enterprise SAS devices. We're just not putting them into a SAN array. We're putting them into a JBOD enclosure, an unintelligent enclosure, and using high-speed SAS HBAs on our servers to get that raw connectivity speed through. Mm-hmm. And then Storage Spaces does a lot of what that secret sauce in the SAN world typically does on storage controllers. It helps to pool your physical disks together, virtualize and carve those out into various LUNs, present them back to either local servers or through SMB, remote servers, and then be able to cache that access as well for improved performance. In the R2 release, we've also added storage tiering. Have you had a chance to take a look at storage tiering yet at all, Andy?
A little bit. Tinkered with it somewhat. You know, it's for a test environment, it's hard to get a hold of SSDs with it, as expensive as they still are. But it certainly is a nice feature with the testing I've done. The ability to move those frequently accessed files and blocks onto SSDs automatically, you know, you're kind of taking some of the secret sauce from the traditional SAN manufacturers and embedding it right into Windows Server 2012. And really, you're taking the mystery out of storage, really. You're just putting it all right out there for Server 2012 to handle for you. And it's really beneficial.
Yeah, definitely. It's a really cool technology because it allows us to, as you had mentioned, use a small number, small amount of SSD storage to really provide some intelligent placement and write caching for our larger amount of data. Behind the scenes, once it's enabled, Server 2012 R2 will automatically move your blocks back and forth between SSD and spinning disk tiers to optimize your most frequently accessed blocks of data being leveraged from the fast SSD disk without having to invest in trays and trays and trays of those expensive SSDs. You can take kind of that 70-30 or 60-40 rule of thumb to say, well, if I've got a couple terabytes of storage, but I know that only about 30% of that storage is frequently really hit hard, I can take 30% of my overall storage investment, invest it in an SSD, take the rest of that, and invest it in slower speed enterprise SAS or nearline SATA drives. In fact, we've seen a lot of environments actually save money by not having to purchase expensive 15K drives, by leveraging a small amount of SSD and then a larger amount of 7.2K RPM drives, nearline SATA drives with SAS interfaces on them, to ultimately get better performance out of the storage solution without having to buy the more expensive 15K SAS drives. Well, Andy, what do you think? Does it make sense to jump over into the lab and show everybody a little bit more about configuring storage spaces in R2?
Yeah, should be a good demo.
Okay, great. Well, I'll see you over in the lab in just a few minutes.
All righty.
Well, hey, Andy, here we are over in our lab environment, and we're looking at one of the Server 2012 R2 hosts that we have with a bunch of physical disks connected to it in an enterprise-class JBOD environment. And we're going to look at storage spaces as a great solution for presenting very high-performance, resilient storage, either to one Hyper-V host directly or to several Hyper-V hosts within a clustered environment as a shared, inexpensive shared storage solution. And in order to configure all that, we can use our built-in server manager tool. So we're looking at the base server manager dashboard page that we normally see when we launch server manager in our 2012 box. And I'm going to go over to File and Storage Services. So I'm going to click over in my left navigation area and open that page up. And as we roll down the various selections on the File and Storage Services page, we'll see storage pools listed there. And inside the storage pools page, down in the bottom right-hand corner, we've got this physical disks list. So what physical disks shows us is the disks that are directly attached to the server that I've currently selected up on the top. So in this case, I'm looking at the disks that are attached to my local server. And you'll notice up on the top, it says that they're available to just my local server. So right now, these disks are just attached to one server. But if I was in a clustered environment and I had these disks sitting in a JBOD that was attached to both servers in the cluster, for instance, I'd see each of the clustered server names up here listed under available to. The steps for taking these physical disks and using storage spaces to pool them together and virtualize them together, whether I'm on a single server or in a clustered environment, is really the same. So what I'll do is I'll just take my physical disks down on the lower bottom area, and I'll highlight those. And as I'm doing that, you'll notice I've got different sizes and different media types for my physical disks. So I've got 6 disks in total, 3 that are high-speed SSD disk, and 3 that are slower speed spinning disks, slower hard disks. And if I wanted to pool these together into a storage pool, all I'd have to do is select those disks, and then up on my tasks menu, I'd see the new storage pool choice. I'd click on that, give my new storage pool a name, click OK, and basically it'll create a new storage pool, which is what I ended up with up top here. I created this storage pool called Tiered Pool 1. So it's not a whole lot to creating the storage pool. There's no resiliency or caching or anything of that nature that's brought into force yet. All the storage pool really is just taking the raw capacity of those disks and bringing it into a pool that I can then carve out into resilient LUNs and format as volumes that are cached and whatnot. So I've taken those 6 disks and so far pooled them together into a 2 terabyte storage pool. Now if I want to start using that storage pool and implement the automated tiering that we had talked about, all I have to do is right-click on that new storage pool, select New Virtual Disk, and in the storage spaces world, a virtual disk is what we'd think of typically as a LUN in the traditional storage area networking world. So we're taking a portion of the storage pool, and we're going to carve that out so that we can assign it and use it on our local server, or if we're in a clustered environment, across our cluster. So I'm just going to click on the Next button on my first wizard page. There's my storage pool. If I had several storage pools on various servers in my environment, I see all the storage pools listed here. So I've got centralized storage management from within Server Manager across all the commodity disks that I've pooled together. I'll select my storage pool, click Next, and I'll give my new virtual disk or LUN a name. So I'll just call this LUN 0. And because there's SSD and hard disks within our storage pool, I also have the option to create storage tiers on this LUN. That's going to enable that automatic tiering based on the blocks of data that I'm most frequently accessing across SSD, and the data I'm less frequently accessing automatically being placed on hard disk instead. So I'll check that box, click Next. Now I want to implement some resiliency. So I'm going to select mirroring. Mirroring allows me to mirror at a block level across 2 or 3 physical disks. And the cool thing is storage spaces is also enclosure aware. So if I'm using multiple JBOD enclosures that are connected into my servers, when I do mirroring, storage spaces is smart enough to spread those mirrored copies of each block of data across disks in several enclosures so that even if I have an enclosure outage, it's not taking my LUNs, my virtual disks, offline. So I'll select mirroring. I also have the option of choosing whether I use a 2-way or 3-way mirror. So I'll use a 2-way mirror. And I can choose thin or fixed provisioning. Now, if I'm using the automated storage tiering in R2, that does require fixed provisioning. You'll notice thin is grayed out right now because we want to make sure that as storage spaces is moving blocks back and forth between tiers, that the amount of space we've allocated for each tier is actually pre-allocated and will be available. If we're not using the automated storage tiering, then we can also use thin provisioning as an alternative to initially set up a LUN or a virtual disk without pre-allocating all that disk space so that we can over-allocate disk space across various LUNs. And as our storage pool starts filling up on the back end, we can just on the fly add more physical disk capacity into the pool. So I'll use fixed provisioning because I'm using automated tiering. And then across each of the 2 tiers that I have, my SSD tier and my hard disk tier, I can also customize how much space I want to allocate for each of those tiers. Or if I just want to create one big virtual disk inside the pool and use all the available SSD and hard disk space, I can set it to maximum size. And that's what I'll do. I'll just create one big 1 terabyte volume. I'll go ahead and click the Next button, click Create. And just within a few moments, I've now got a new virtual disk set up. I'll just move my window over for a moment here. So you'll see my new virtual disk as a mirrored layout, 1 terabyte in size. Just set it up within one tool across any of my Windows servers in my environment. Now I've got a LUN that's presented to my local server, or again in a clustered environment to my clustered servers, that I can go ahead and format as a volume and lay down a file system on top of so that I can save data onto that virtual disk. And the wizard for setting up your new virtual disk is smart enough to know that you probably need a file system on top of that virtual disk. So it automatically has by default the checkbox option selected to create a volume when the wizard closes. So if I click close here, it's automatically going to pop up the new volume wizard and step me through the process of formatting that either standalone or clustered volume, or disk rather, that I've just set up as a 1 terabyte NTFS volume. So just like a normal volume, if I'm using this on just a standalone server, I can assign a particular drive letter to that volume. If I'm using it in a clustered environment though, clustered environments typically use cluster shared volumes and mount points to access those volumes. So in a clustered environment, I typically say, don't assign a drive letter or folder, and then I'd use my clustering tool to bring that storage in as a clustered share volume mount point for each of my clustered hosts. So I'll go ahead and assign a drive letter and leave my default file system choices in place. One of the other storage related features that's kind of cool, it's not specifically related to storage spaces, it's more of an NTFS feature in Server 2012, is data deduplication. Built into 2012 and 2012 R2. When I'm formatting an NTFS volume, I can elect in the R2 release to turn on data deduplication either for general document type file storage, or we can actually turn it on for virtual machine data deduplication as well. We've actually tested it primarily for the VDI role of a virtual desktop infrastructure scenario, and that's what's really supported from an online data deduplication standpoint right now. To be able to dedupe down the virtual hard disks that you might have running across various virtualized desktops in a VDI scenario. We're going to be testing it for other types of virtual machine scenarios as well. But right now, the VDI scenario is the one that's really been tested by support, because VDI scenarios tend to be less disk intensive, and so data deduplication doesn't really have any additional noticeable overhead that it places on the VDI role. So if you're using VDI as a solution for delivering desktops in your environment, definitely take advantage of R2 and the online deduplication. In my case, I'll go ahead and leave that disabled and just go through the process.
Real quick.
Yeah.
Comment on the deduplication. We were talking about we were talking about the cost of storage earlier, and deduplication is what we found to be a really cost savings measure in regards to the cost of storage. I've seen almost as high as 60, 70, 80% savings on the amount of storage used when deduplication is enabled on a volume. So that's certainly something everyone needs to check out. One other thing to note on the deduplication, you want to make sure that your backup application supports the deduplication. I have seen some third-party backup solutions. They don't officially support it and could potentially not be able to restore successfully from a backup with dedupe enabled. So keep that in mind.
That's great. That's a great point. And generally, if your backup application is interfacing and doing the backups through the NTFS file system API, it shouldn't have an issue. But if it's doing something that's a little more bare metal from a sector-by-sector imaging standpoint, you may have some complications there. So good advice. Definitely check and make sure that dedupe is supported. And yeah, definitely, as far as the percentage savings, you know, I've seen as high in some environments as 85% savings. A lot of it certainly depends on how duplicative your storage is.
Yep.
Usually the higher savings that I've seen have been around environments that we're deduping maybe some virtual machine template folders or archive folders, particularly in environments where most of your virtual machines are running common operating systems. Dedupe can help to streamline the amount of disk space by single instancing all those common blocks across all your virtual hard disks sitting in a template folder, or now with R2, all of those common blocks sitting across your running VDI VMs you know, particularly if you've got hundreds of VMs presenting Windows 7 or Windows 8 desktop environments, there's a lot of duplicative storage across all those VMs that can be single instance down to a single copy.
Yep, absolutely.
Great. Well, I'm going to go ahead. I've finished formatting the volume. I'll go ahead and click close. Now I've got my new volume formatted as my F drive, and we'll see here we have a 1 terabyte volume with auto tiering enabled using commodity disks. That, it was really simple to configure. What do you think, Andy? Has it been pretty easy to step through that process?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've set up some SANs where it's just a headache to, you know, create your storage pool and provision your various LUNs and get everything connected. I mean, this, you know, really, you could set up a file server and have storage configured in, you know, 30, 40 minutes tops. You know, it's pretty simple to configure.
Yep, definitely. And so this storage is currently usable by the single server. We could certainly bring it just as easily into a cluster of Hyper-V hosts that are directly attached to the same set of JBOD enclosures through SAS HBA connectivity. Really, the limiting factor from a scale-out standpoint in this particular scenario is how many physical hosts you can attach to a SAS JBOD through HBA connections. And what I've seen generally out in the practical in the real world from a practical hardware limitation is this being a solution for anywhere from 2 to 4 Hyper-V hosts that have SAS HBAs in them and are directly connected into a SAS JBOD. Because once you start growing past that 2 to 4 host space, generally you don't have enough ports without adding in the complexity of additional SAS expanders and whatnot to be able to connect those other servers.
No.
In fact, we've got some really interesting OEM solutions that we're seeing a lot of interest in the kind of the mid-market and small and medium business market. We've got OEMs that have taken the equivalent of JBOD enclosures and 2 to 4 blade servers and package them into a single 2 or 4U enclosure that we call a cluster-in-a-box configuration. So in a 2 or 4U space, you can have 2 Hyper-V hosts, up to 4 Hyper-V hosts, running Server 2012 R2 with internal SAS, high-speed SAS backplane connectivity to a shelf of disks that are a combination between SSD and hard disks. If you're in that mid-market space and you're thinking about adding just a couple Hyper-V hosts into your environment and need some storage, definitely check out the cluster-in-a-box solutions. They're a pretty cool technology for consolidating the rack density down of what you can do in very small footprint.
Yeah, whenever you got a data center in mind, saturation of your rack space is always a concern. Because especially when you're doing, as a service provider, when you're doing colo and things of that nature, you know, rack space is a premium. So you want to get the most out of it that you can.
Definitely, definitely. Well, now if we wanted to scale, I guess the next question is, what happens if we have more than 2 to 4 Hyper-V hosts? How do we scale this type of storage solution out to support 10 or 20 or, you know, potentially hundreds of Hyper-V hosts as more of a network attached storage solution? And that's really where our SMB 3.0 protocol comes into play. It's actually been updated with some additional enhancements in Server 2012 R2, so the new version number is 3.02 officially, and our scale out file server support for being able to use Windows Server 2012 file servers effectively as, in the SAN world, what we'd call storage controllers, to be able to present your JBOD enclosures, all that virtualized storage that Storage Spaces is building out, to present that across high-speed network connections out to you know, lots of Hyper-V hosts, just, you know, using 1 gig or 10 gig Ethernet, or in some data center environments, I see them evaluating even 40 gig Ethernet or InfiniBand. In fact, it's kind of an interesting story with it, with the 40 gig Ethernet and InfiniBand, particularly if we're using multiple high-speed connections to present the storage. We're actually seeing the saturation point now being driven by the system bus speeds of your servers, because we're able to run SMB protocol for presenting storage and whatnot at the bus speed of internal servers by using 3 or 4 40 gig Ethernet or 56 gig InfiniBand connections. So you're starting to get to the point where using commodity hardware, you're actually not only providing an enterprise class performance solution that's on par with much more expensive solutions like fiber channel storage, but can actually exceed the performance of fiber channel storage and be on par with what you would otherwise have achieved with just direct attached storage in a physical server. So it's really been pretty impressive from that standpoint. Have you had a chance to play around with scale-out file servers at all, Andy?
A little bit. We've evaluated it quite a bit. We're really looking at it as a replacement for, like you said, some of those more expensive storage solutions. So yep. it really looks promising.
Yeah, definitely. And it's really easy to configure as well in our demo environment here. I'm just going to switch over to one of my other machines here and jump into our failover cluster manager tool. Because Scale-Out File Server is a new cluster role that's supported in Server 2012 and 2012 R2 for turning commodity Windows server machines into storage controllers that run over that new SMB3.0 protocol. You'll notice I've already got a scale-out file server configured, but let's step through what I did to set this up. So in Failover Cluster Manager, all I needed to do is initially bring in my existing Windows servers that I wish to cluster together by clicking on Create Cluster, and I step through the process of adding those servers in. So I'll just go ahead and add those servers in. Oop, let me type in the right server name here.
That kind of helps. Computers tend to do exactly what you tell them to do, don't they?
Yeah, they do. They do. So I'll add in a couple of my existing Windows servers. And I'll click Next. I have the option of running through a quick configuration validation check to make sure everything's up and running. If I was setting up a production cluster, I definitely would want to take the time to do that to make sure I'm using best practices for configuring my cluster. But in our demo environment, I'll just skip through that step. And then I'd give my cluster a name that I'd use for accessing that cluster from a management standpoint. So I might have, you know, maybe something like SAN01, for instance, as my cluster name. Go through the process. Oh, that's already, let's try a unique name. I go through the process of configuring my cluster. That's already in use as well. How about 3? Let's see. There we go. Third time's the charm. I'd go through the process. You can see I've got lots of clusters set up in my environment. I go through the process of confirming those settings. And the checkbox down below will automatically add all of the storage that both of these servers see into the cluster so that I can present it through the cluster as a shared storage resource to the other hosts. So if I had storage spaces configured and presenting virtual disks to both of those servers, both of those servers being directly connected to a set of JBOD enclosures, just by leaving that box checked, it's going to bring in all of my storage into the cluster. I won't actually create the new cluster right now because I do already have an existing cluster created. So I've got under nodes, I've got my two nodes, my two servers that I brought into the cluster. They're both in an up state. If I needed more storage, caching, or computing horsepower, I could actually extend this scale-out cluster to include up to 8 physical servers. So I've got the ability to scale with this solution, the ability to scale out my storage connectivity and caching capabilities out to hundreds of hosts. And then I can separately scale out my storage capacity and performance by adding additional JBODs behind those servers and then adding SSD and spinning disk to balance my performance versus capacity needs into those JBOD enclosures. Because I left that checkbox selected to add all of my storage in, under disks, you'll see it brought my storage in place. So here's the disks that both of those servers could see. And in order to use them as shared storage within the cluster, what I'd do is I'd right-click, and there'd be a choice here normally that would say Add to Cluster Shared Volumes. I've already done that. See, it appears as a cluster shared volume. So now I don't get the add choice, I get the remove choice. But the first time through, it'll appear as just an available disk that I can right click on and add as a cluster shared volume. cluster shared volumes are our multi-server file system technology. So it allows that NTFS file system that we originally formatted our storage space with, our virtual disk with, to be multi-server accessible as soon as we bring it into a cluster shared volume for read and write activity. That's what we call scale-out file server, an active-active configuration, because all of the servers that are attached to the storage can be actively reading and writing concurrently to that shared storage. And they're intelligent enough to spread the client connections that's accessing that storage through the scale-out file server across all of the available nodes. It's a really cool solution. Now, in order to set up a scale-out file server cluster role that's going to present that storage over our network, I just add a role in that uses the scale-out file server role type. So in order to get this scale-out file server role running within my cluster, all I did is on my roles node in Failover Cluster Manager, I right-clicked, selected Configure Role, and then I stepped through the process of selecting the file server role as the role I wish to add into my cluster. When I do that with 2012 or 2012R2, that's where I get the new choice to appear that I can select for the scale-out file server role for application data. That's that high-performance storage controller role that works over our new SMB protocol in an active-active basis. It's currently tested and supported for presenting storage to Hyper-V hosts. We are storing virtual machines in SMB shares on a scale-out file server, or for presenting storage to SQL database servers. We are storing databases and logs in a set of shares presented by a scale-out file server. So I'd step through the process of giving my scale-out file server a name. This will be the name that we would use in our UNC paths to access any shares that we're presenting through that scale-out file server, and then confirm, click next and finish, and boom, it'll create it, just like I have here. Once I select my scale-out file server role, then to add additional shares across any of the storage that cluster can see, I simply go down to add file share and step through the process of adding one or more file shares using the SMB share for applications choice. Just like I have, I'm just going to move this over here, just like I have down here. So I've got various shares on my scale-out file server for images and ISOs, for storing virtual hard disks, and for storing virtual machine configurations. Once that's set up then, as I'm building new virtual machines to use that storage, all I would do is in my virtual machine path, if I go into the settings of a particular virtual machine, I would use that UNC path as the path to where I'm storing my virtual machine and virtual hard disk files. So instead of using a local drive letter path, using a UNC path that's pointing to the scale-out file server, the scale-out file server is caching and processing and presenting all of that storage for me that I'm accessing over here in Hyper-V Manager from my Hyper-V host. Well, Andy, what do you think? Pretty easy to set up a SAN-like equivalent in Server 2012 or 2012R2 to what you've experienced in the past with iSCSI and Fiber Channel alternatives?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, my personal favorite thing about it is you're doing all this with Windows Server tools. I mean, it's all stuff that you're used to using, and, you know, it's got that familiar, what I call the familiar at-home Microsoft feel to it, you know, so...
Yep, exactly. You don't have to worry about jumping into your SAN administration tools to carve out your LUNs, jumping into your fiber channel switching tools to do your SAN zoning, jumping over to your HBA management tools to make sure the disks are connected, and then finally having to then see the disks and format them and work with them separately. You know, I've talked to other IT pros and they say, well, oh my gosh, going through this process, I've used basically one consistent set of tooling from one place to do all this work. This would have taken me easily 5 or 6 different utilities across 5 or 6 different types of components within my storage area network in order to do the same work. It's going to save me so much time.
Absolutely. I mean, plus the chance for error is much less as well because you're not using all those different utilities. So that's a good thing as well.
Yep, definitely. Now, the interesting piece is that over on the failover cluster manager, when I was sharing new shares, you may have noticed that I don't have just SMB protocol shares that I can create. I also have the ability to create NFS shares as well. And that's kind of cool because even if you're in an environment today where you have lots of VMware or Linux or Unix hosts and you're not ready to make the move quite yet to Hyper-V, you can still take advantage of storage spaces and Windows clustered file servers to present storage, commodity storage, as NFS mount points to your VMware hosts that they can use as remotely mounted VM data stores, or to Linux or Unix hosts or virtual machines within your environment. Now, the NFS sharing doesn't work with the scale-out file server role, so you won't get the active-active support. It still is very high performance. Our NFS protocol team actually does a great job of ensuring that we're staying to spec with the NFS protocol specifications. They attend all the NFS protocol bake-offs in the storage industry to make sure they are providing comparable performance to what many of the high-end NFS NAS solutions are providing. But in order to configure this on a Windows server, we could actually do it right within the same cluster, but we'd have to configure it as a separate role where we would go through the process of configuring our role still as a file server role, but instead of being the active-active scale-out choice, we would use the file server for general use choice. That supports the NFS protocol as well. And that gives us high performance, it gives us high availability, but the nodes within our cluster would support that role in an active-passive configuration so that only one of the nodes would be actively processing the NFS requests at a time. If that node failed, though, we have continuous availability failover, seamless failover, without interruption to your NFS clients to that storage as it fails over to another node in the cluster. So we can select file server for general use, and we could have a, maybe we'll say NFS NAS 01, another name that we use within the same cluster. And if we had storage available, another virtual disk, we'd simply add it in and be able to have that as another clustered role. And then once we've done that, it's adding those NFS shares is just like adding the SMB shares. We'd right-click on that role, add file share, but instead of selecting the SMB share choices, we'd select the NFS share choices instead, and then step through the process of making that available as a set of NFS shares that can be remotely mounted from other hosts, VMware hosts, Linux hosts, or Unix hosts. So we're starting to see a lot of storage interest inside heterogeneous customer organizations where they're saying, I see the value of this storage. I don't want to wait until I'm ready to add new Hyper-V hosts into my environment to take advantage of this. Let me put the infrastructure in place, begin exposing that storage today through NFS, and then at a later point, come back around and start exposing it through SMB out to my Hyper-V hosts as I add those into my network to grow my virtualization host capacity. What do you think, Andy? Is that NFS support something that you think VMware customers would be able to take advantage of to reduce their storage costs?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they can leverage their existing investments. You know, they don't have to reinvent the wheel as far as their virtualization hosts are concerned. The ability to use NFS, really helps sell the idea of Hyper-V at a later point in time.
Great. Well, Andy, we've stepped through a number of storage enhancements that are available in both Server 2012 and then also 2012 R2 with some of the new updates around automated storage tiering and better tuning for high-speed network interfaces where we're presenting storage via SMB today. We also, along the way, looked at some of our traditional support via iSCSI and Fiber Channel SAN. So if you have an investment in an existing SAN today, you don't have to change out your storage just to leverage Hyper-V, but as you're growing your storage investment or replacing your SAN at an end-of-life point in time, certainly looking at storage spaces and scale-out file server is something that I think a lot of IT pros can benefit from. And I certainly appreciate your time today, Andy, and walking through our various storage options together with all the IT pros that are tuning in today. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. Not a problem. Thanks for having me, Keith.
Sure thing. And if you're interested as an IT professional in learning more about the storage options that are available as your next SAN configuration using commodity hardware with either Windows Server 2012 or 2012 R2, be sure to take advantage of some of the links that are below on the page. We've got some great step-by-step resources on leveraging the new storage technologies in Windows Server 2012 and 2012 R2, as well as the blog that that Andy is an author of and my blog out on Microsoft TechNet as well. Well, until we see each other again next time, hope you enjoyed this episode and have a great rest of your day. I look forward to seeing you at another episode of TechNet Radio, Hyper-V from a VMware admin's perspective. Thanks, everybody, for joining today.
Have a good one. Thanks.